The most innately and essentially malevolent scoundrel that God Almighty ever put on earth.
If you went to high school in the United States sometime in the past 40 to 50 years, or consider yourself a baby boomer, chances are you were required to read and write a book report on the most famous muckraking novel ever written. In other words, the subject of today's program is part of the American conscience. Hi, I'm Brian DeShazer, and this is From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archives series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio. In 1906, more than a century ago, at the peak of the Gilded Age, when fat cats with spats, top hats, and tails ruled the world, and industry was king, an unlikely champion upset the balance forever. Author Upton Sinclair published his novel The Jungle, a graphic portrait of life in a turn-of-the-century American meatpacking factory. Although public response to the book would lead to the establishment of the Pure Food and Drug Act, Sinclair's main focus, a demand for workers' rights, labor reform, and gender protection in the workplace, went disappointingly unrealized. Nonetheless, Upton Sinclair's contribution to literature and social reform is evidenced in the life and work of men and women like Rachel Carson, Jessica Mitford, Ralph Nader, and Pacifica's own Amy Goodman. Now fast forward to 1962. Now in his 80s, Upton Sinclair took time to lecture on the campus of Pomona College in California before an audience of college students whose book reports on the jungle were probably still fresh in their minds. Upton Sinclair speaks to us with his trademark plain-spoken directness of how each of us, as single individuals, often standing against seemingly insurmountable odds, can change a nation, and perhaps the world. From the Vault is proud to air this important example of Pacifica's rich broadcast legacy, preserved and presented so that one man's truth might continue to inspire. And now, Upton Sinclair, Changing America.
As for Upton Sinclair, the political figure, you all know that he was the Democratic candidate for governor of California in 1934 on the epic End Poverty in California platform, and he came mighty close to being elected. Now let me turn from the political to the literary. Upton Sinclair as a writer. By the age of 18, he was publishing more than 1 million words a year in what he called his half-dime novels. Like Byron with Child Harold, he became famous overnight with The Jungle, his expose of the Chicago stockyards. Now, in such famous novels as Oil and The Brass Check, Upton Sinclair became known as a muckraker. The muck he raked up was prodigious. And what this country needs today is not a good 5-cent cigar, but a good $5 muckrake. With a man as vigorous and devoted as Upton Sinclair wielding it. And I would guess that his favorite quotation is this, from George Bernard Shaw. When people ask me what has happened in my long lifetime, I do not refer them to the newspaper files, but to Upton Sinclair's novels. And I now refer you to the man himself, a man for whom I feel admiration and affection, Upton Sinclair.
Well, boys and girls, I told Dick I was, he didn't mention, but I told him I was going to talk on the subject of changing America. And I don't mean by that that America is changing. I mean how to change America. And a few of the interesting things that will happen to you if you try. When you try. And I'm going to start a little way back, which may seem queer, but he mentioned Albert Einstein, and I'll tell you a little about Albert Einstein. He was in Pasadena teaching at Caltech for a couple of winter seasons. And I saw a great deal of him, and he was one of the sweetest and kindest human beings I ever knew. From first to last, he never refused any request that I made of him. And when he left the last time, he presented me with a very beautiful photograph, a photograph almost big enough to be a painting. It had been taken by a friend in my home, and Einstein gave me the original and wrote a poem underneath in the German language. And I won't assume that you know German, and I won't translate the poem because it was a very nice poem from my point of view, but it might seem egotistical if I quoted it, and I'm only mentioning it on account of the funny episode that happened. A few weeks or perhaps 2 months ago, at the magazine Life published 6 pages of American pictures of American rocking chairs. And I wrote them a little note telling them that they'd left out the most characteristic American rocking chair, which is the cradle rocker. And I sent them a picture of me sitting in the cradle rocker. Some of you may have seen it. And it happened that the Einstein photograph was right behind the rocking chair, so I said in my letter that you'll see Einstein in the background, and he loved this rocking chair and sat in it whenever he came to our home. And I didn't say anything about the poem that he wrote. But I received a call from the Hollywood editor of Life, a woman, asking me to let them have the text of the poem. And I said, it's in German. Do you know German? She said, no, she didn't, but couldn't I translate it for her? And I said, yes, but it wouldn't do any good because Life wouldn't publish it. And she said, why not? Which was rather naive of her. And I said, because it praises me. And then she burst out laughing, just as you did. She thought that was very funny. She said she was quite sure Life would publish it. And so I read her a translation of the poem, and she patiently wrote 6 lines of poetry. And Life published my letter, and it published the picture of the rocking chair and did not publish the poem. So the next time I had a telephone call from that lady, I said, I know more about Life than you do. And all this is preliminary to what happened 10 days or 2 weeks ago, when I came out here to get married. And there were a whole lot of newspaper reporters, as you probably know, and they tried to get into the church and they weren't let in. But one of them was a man from Life. And he had a very special proposition, he said. Life wanted to publish photographs of the wedding, and they also wanted to publish an interview with me. Well, I thought it was the same old proposition again. I said, you'll get the interview all right, but Life won't publish it. And sure enough, that's the way it happened. And the only reason I tell that story is preliminary. I went down to my home and I met the man there by appointment. He was a very, very nice fellow and very eager and interested in what I told him. At least he had the tact to pretend to be. And he wrote elaborate notes, and I guess he asked me 100 questions. And it all, the reason I'm telling you about it, you'll now see, it all had to do with changing America. He was amused by the idea, and he wanted me to tell some of the ways in which I had tried to change America, and what luck, good or bad, I had had. So I told him once more, I said, "Life won't publish it." Well, he wanted it, so I gave it to him, and he sat and he wrote notes for a couple of hours, and nothing has appeared in Life. But I thought to myself, well, since I can't tell those stories to the 5 million readers of Life, I'll tell them at least a brief glimpse of them to the 500 college boys and girls up here in Pomona College. So that's why I said I was going to talk about changing America. In the year 1905, there was a strike of the workers in the Chicago stockyards. It was put down with terrible violence, which was customary in those backward, far-off days. And the strike was completely broken, and the workers went back to conditions which were described as very terrible. And so I decided that I was going to write a book about the Chicago stockyards from the point of view of labor. And I made the there was a socialist paper at that time which had a 500,000 circulation, The Appeal to Reason. And the editor agreed to put up $500, and I said I could live on that while I went out to the stockyards and studied conditions, and then came home and wrote the novel. I didn't know it was going to be quite as long a novel as it proved to be. But anyway, I found most hideous conditions. And one of the working men gave me a wonderful idea. He said, "You can see anything you want to see in any of these packing houses. All you have to do is to put on old clothes and carry a dinner pail. And you can walk through any room, no matter how secret, nobody will pay any attention to you. Don't stop and look around, but just walk and look as you walk. And everybody will think you're on your way to a job." And so I did that. I didn't have anything but old clothes, so it was very easy for me. And I walked through the yards, and I saw filth beyond belief. And I studied the laws, and among the interesting things I discovered was that all the meat that the United States government inspectors condemned were dropped through chutes, or whatever the openings were, down to a lower floor in the basement, and was there processed and sold to the people of Chicago and environs. And when I looked it up, I discovered that that was the law, that the United States government inspected only for the rest of America, and that local people took what was left over. And I went home and wrote The Jungle, as I said at the time, or just afterwards, blinded by my own tears, the most terrible things I had seen. Unbelievable things that the people had told me, but I had inquired around, And I'd carried my little dinner pail, and I had seen things. Well, I went home and wrote The Jungle, and I took it to first the Macmillan Company, who had published my previous novel about the Civil War, and the president of the company said he had no doubt that it would make a terrible sensation, but I'd have to leave out some of the blood and guts, as he phrased it, or the respectable firm couldn't publish the book. So I went elsewhere. I tried 5 different publishers, and they all said the same thing. So I borrowed some money and decided I'd publish the book myself. I had to do that 6 times in the course of my life. And just as I had the book in type and ready to go to press, I found a publisher. Doubleday, Page and Company in New York. It's now Doubleday. And they said they'd first have to send somebody out to investigate. And they sent a young lawyer whom they knew and trusted, and he went out. And he came back. And I'm stopping for a moment to make sure I've got this odd story straight. He went first to the Armors and told them what it was coming for and asked permission to go through the plants without carrying a dinner pail. And they gave him permission, but they told him that they... Oh, no, no. And I see, it's rather complicated, and I have to be sure to get it straight. He went to the Chicago Tribune first, and they told him they had made a thorough investigation of the jungle, had their independent men do it, and they turned over an elaborate report showing that everything in the jungle were lies, and all the conditions were perfect. And the young lawyer put that away in his suitcase. And when he went to the plant to be shown around, they introduced him to their publicity man. And the publicity man said, "The jungle? Oh yes, I know all about that. I read a manuscript to that book and prepared a thorough report on it for the Chicago Tribune." That was the independent investigation that Doubleday Page was asked to accept. So, of course, they didn't accept it. They published the book and they stood by it. And it made a tremendous sensation all over the country. People couldn't believe these horrors. For instance, the Chicago Tribune published again and again the denial that any condemned meat was ever sold in Chicago. And the fact was that they only had to turn to page so-and-so in the jungle. I don't remember the page number, but at the foot of the page, as a footnote, I had given the text of the law that permitted it. And still the Chicago Tribune had the nerve to publish that particular false statement. I wrote to President Roosevelt, Teddy Roosevelt, the first one, and he wrote and made an appointment for me to come to Washington and talk to him. And one of the first things he told me was that he didn't say anything about any independent report. He said, "Mr. Sinclair, I know those peckers because I had to eat the meat they sent for the army in Cuba." So then I knew I had a friend. I'd get a different kind of independent report. And I see I've got a good substantial desk here, so I can imitate to you the conversation of President Roosevelt on the subject of control of the United States Senate by big business interests. And Teddy Roosevelt later, you know, used the phrase, a man with a muckrake. He changed it to muckraker. He never called me a muckraker, but of course a lot of other people took it up and did. But I had sat at the luncheon table in the White House while, mind you, the reason he used the phrase man with the muckrake was a series of articles. This was a year or two after the jungle. A series of articles that had been written by the novelist Phillips, David Graham Phillips, in which he had attacked some of the corrupt United States senators. I say corrupt from the point of view that they represented special interests which had put up the money to elect them. But in the time when he was talking to me, before he was ready to talk about muckrakers, Teddy Roosevelt had sat at his luncheon table, and I can't recall all that he said about all the United States senators, but when I went out, I wrote down right quickly what he had said about Senator Hale of Maine. And ladies and gentlemen, as you listen, please understand that it's Teddy Roosevelt talking and not me. And when I hit this desk, of course, it doesn't make quite as much noise as the table in the lunching room at the White House, but it made a good size noise in that room. The most innately and essentially malevolent scoundrel that God Almighty ever put on earth. That was the President of the United States expressing his opinion of Senator Hale of Maine, a leading Republican gentleman of the time. Well, Teddy Roosevelt gave me a square deal. He appointed two commissioners. I gave them references and introduced them to people who could take them here and there. And they didn't go out and take the word of the Packers or the Packers publicity man. They went out and saw, and they went all over the yards, and they came back and they told Roosevelt, I suppose they turned in a report to him. I didn't see that. But Roosevelt turned me over to those two commissioners, and they talked to me and they let me make notes. And they didn't say one word about any of it being confidential. And of course, I had sense enough not to ask. I knew that they wanted to put the responsibility on me and not have me put it on them. So I got the first train to New York, and I arrived in the office of the New York Times along about 10:30 in the morning, in the evening. And it happened I knew the managing editor of the Times very well because we'd lived in open camps up in the Adirondack Mountains, right close to each other, alongside each other. So when I came in, I saw him right away. V.C. Vananda was his name. And I told him what I had. He took up his telephone and he said, stop the presses. And he got a stenographer, and I talked for 2 minutes, and he got another stenographer, and I talked for another 2 minutes, and it's like that story of another grasshopper came and got another ear of grain of corn, and so on. And that account was written, I would say, dictated to half a dozen different stenographers, and they all went off and typed 2 minutes of dictation and then came running back for more. And I doubt if the presses were held up for more than half an hour in order to get that story and it appeared next morning on the front page of the New York Times saying, Roosevelt's AIDS talk. And it told the whole story of what they had found. Well, of course, that settled the matter. Congress had to pass laws providing for real inspection of foodstuffs. And you can eat your meat with a little more assurance now than you could in those days. I'm not saying that you should eat meat, because I don't and get along very nicely without it. But if you want to eat it, it isn't as dangerous as it used to be. And that's what I mean by changing America. It was a very small change, of course, because, of course, if some of you died of ptomaine poisoning, there'd still be plenty of other students coming to college. And I'll end that story with one more little anecdote. I was in Bermuda a year and a half later, and I went in a little grocery store by the roadside to buy something, and I looked up, and up on a high shelf, I saw some cans of exactly the shape that I recognized, and they were all covered with dust. And I said to the man, "What are those cans up there?" And he said, "Oh, some fellow wrote a book about American meat, and I haven't been able to sell one of those cans since." Well, that's the story of the jungle.
You are listening to From the Vault, the Pacifica Radio Archive series that brings our history out of the vault and onto the radio.
Several of your critics said that you would have had gotten your point across many more times than you did if you had taken yourself less seriously. Would you care to comment on that?
Why, yes, of course. If I hadn't taken myself seriously, I wouldn't have done the disagreeable things that I did. I assure you, when there were 600 men jammed into a jail, almost being suffocated down at the harbor of Los Angeles, and when children had, some of the strikers who tried to carry placards or something, I don't know just what they did, but they were picked up and thrown into a vat of hot coffee, and things like that were happening down at the harbor, I didn't find it pleasant to go down there and get arrested and have a half-drunken maniac of a police chief hold me incommunicado for 20 hours and try to get me committed just on the point that court was closing the next day, so that I couldn't get bail, so that he could have me in jail that night to give me the third degree. I assure you, I didn't go through that experience with any sense of pleasure. It wasn't agreeable, and I wasn't making myself agreeable. I was doing it with desperation in my soul, and my wife was nearly crazy with anxiety. And by golly, I was taking myself seriously, you bet, when I did it. And I could name, I don't know how many, a dozen things like that I did. The whole epic campaign when I traveled over the United States and never knew whether somebody was going to shoot me any minute while I was making my speeches, or that my health was going to break down, or that my last dollar was going to be spent. And I was taking it seriously, I assure you. And when you do things like that, you have to not merely take yourself seriously, you have to take your country seriously and the institutions of your country. You have to believe in America, and you have to believe in democracy. And by golly, if other people don't, you have to tell them to. And they don't like it because you're finding fault with them and trying to change them, and they don't want to be changed. They want to play and get drunk.